Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 7th of February, a day when everybody in Wisconsin who follows the Packers, and that includes most of the state, I think, is very, very happy today. Congratulations to the Green Bay Packers on their win. Super Bowl victory yesterday. It feels good today. This hour, it's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays from 9 until 10. And our guest this hour is Professor Kalila Brown Dean, who is a professor of political science and African American studies at Yale University. She is resident fellow of the Institute for Social and Policy Studies, and also she is a research fellow for the Center for International and Area Studies at Yale. Her work stands at the intersections of law, politics, and policy, with specializations in American politics, mass political behavior, crime and punishment, and political psychology, and she's published work on issues such as voting rights, group identity and public opinion, civic engagement, and the race education nexus. She introduced a new course on Black and Jewish community politics a few years ago. And her research right now focuses on the political dynamics surrounding the American criminal justice system. She is the author of the book Once Convicted, Forever Doomed, Race, Ex-Felon, Disenfranchisement, and Fractured Citizenship. And she is our guest the hour for All Things Political today. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would care to use that today, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Brown, Dean, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's start with Egypt here, where the Times had an interesting article yesterday, the Week in Review section, which is one of my favorites of the paper, talking about America's support for the military-led regime, that we tend to do this, that we prop up dictators in various parts of the world for a long period of time because it's in our interest, and all of a sudden it comes back to bite us. Is the United States learning a lesson through all that we've been seeing the last week in Egypt, do you think?
I think that we definitely should be learning a lesson. I think the United States has always been aware that what we do in the short term is often based on long-term interests. So whether that's determining which leaders we want to support, what types of resources we want to channel into a country, it's always about this longer vision of what that will mean for U.S. interests, not just in that country, but also in the broader region and the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So to think about what's going on in Egypt now, but also in many ways what's going on in Haiti right now, and the sort of long-term relationship and contentious relationship that the United States has had with both of those countries.
In Egypt, is it that we have some concern about what will happen next? Are we concerned that there will be a fundamentalist government installed in Egypt, and that's why we've propped up a guy who has not been kind to his people?
Well, I think that there are two reasons that we're really looking at Egypt right now. One is, what will the next regime look like?
Mm-hmm.
Will it be a regime that is independent and not interested in sort of listening to what the United States has to say or taking direction? But also, what will it mean for U.S. interests in terms of counterterrorism activities? So for better or worse, Mubarak led a very successful counterterrorism regime within Egypt to prevent terrorist attacks, not just within that region, but also within the United States. And so there's a concern about what will happen with the next leadership. What will this new regime mean for countries like Israel? Israel's
right.
Two longest borders right now are with Egypt and with Jordan. And when you see change within Egypt and Jordan happening simultaneously, what will that mean for security interests for people within Israel?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of concern about what this change will mean for that entire regime, for that entire region. And when we think about terrorism and peace, what will this regime think about those concerns?
And do you think it will go beyond Tunisia, Egypt, and Yemen, and Jordan, that it will have ramifications for other strong-arm governments in the region?
I think so. You know, to think about revolution and change, it never happens in a vacuum. It's never overnight that people just decide they are so aggrieved that they want to demand this change. These are tensions that have been long brewing, concerns that have been long raised. And the conditions have changed so that you had this spark on January 25th. But I think there's a lot of concern for people within all of those countries that you named about what do the people demand? To whom will they be accountable? From whom will they get that type of focus and attention that they need? And then how will other countries sort of build upon that for their own revolutionary needs?
You talk about this being long brewing. Did we know that this was bubbling and we just ignored it, or do we have so little sense of what's happening among people in other countries that we didn't even sense it was going to happen?
I think it always really depends on, you know, who you're asking about that. I think the people in Egypt, to think about a country that has over 80 million people who live basically on $2 a day. People in Egypt have been saying for quite some time, this is a problem. Our economic interests are at stake. You know, our ability to provide for our young people and to give them an incentive to become educated, to start careers and stay within Egypt, and because that's becoming a major issue, this sort of brain drain that happens, that's been going for quite some time. And I think the United States has been aware of it. I think that the focus is, you know, what will the leader do to sort of change that?
Right. I was just amazed to hear how journalists were being treated. I'm sure you've read some of the accounts as well. This was frightening, wasn't it?
So, you know, think of someone like Anderson Cooper saying with a very heavy heart, I have to leave.
Yes.
To, you know, see Christiane Amanpour and other journalists, you know, even a Google executive who is right there in the square, and his family is hoping he will be released today. I think it's a question of what is the journalistic responsibility? We need to know what is going on there. The people of Egypt and other countries who are involved in these issues need to have a voice and an outlet. But then you have protesters saying, but this is our movement, this is our revolution, and we don't want outsiders dictating the message that others receive. You know, to think about, you know, sort of the revolution won't be televised, but it was tweeted, right? To have Twitter abuzz with people communicating instantly, this is what's going on, and then that network shutting down. What does it mean for the voice of the people of Egypt, but also the journalists who are risking their lives to tell their story?
I really wish, and it's such a weird thing that Al Jazeera is only seeing what in Washington, D.C. and Burlington, Vermont, of all places.
Right.
It's too bad that we don't have that outlet right now so we would get a much deeper understanding of what's going on.
And I think we need that also, that historical perspective that like Al Jazeera could offer in a way that other stations could not, to help us understand what is really going on in Egypt. What is that history of tension? What is it that we have missed as an American people? And what are really the concerns of people in Egypt? So that it's not us as outsiders telling Egypt what is best for the country and for its people, but having that authentic indigenous voice saying, these are our concerns, these are our demands, and let that sort of course of action flow naturally.
What do we do, and you're a professor at a very prestigious university, what do we do about playing catch-up? Because it seems to me when these large events take place, we just don't have much of a clue of, A, what the grievances are, B, what the history is, so that we can formulate some ideas about what a future should be. We just don't seem to know what's going on.
Right. I think awareness and information are critically important for all Americans. I tend to say to my students, I want you to become responsible and informed global citizens. Doesn't mean that they have to have an opinion on every world event or every world leader, and often I don't think that they should. I certainly don't. But I think that we need to be aware that there are things going on in the rest of the world, and to understand that what's happening in Egypt is really inextricably linked to what's happening here in the United States. To think about what it meant for people in America to say, we need to have a revolution. And now the way that we, you know, define revolution and the ways that we engage in change are very different. But to understand there is an historical precedent there. And so I think that access to information, being aware of what's going on in the rest of the world and not so caught up And it's easy to do because certainly we face a lot of challenges. But to be aware of the rest of the world, I think, is an important first step.
Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan would have turned 100 years old yesterday, which is hard to believe.
Right. There
have been differing commentaries on what he did politically in this country and what he did in terms of tax policy, et cetera. One of the critics in yesterday's Times was saying that he really created this beginning of this large gap between those who have and those who do not have in terms of tax policy in this country. Was that a change that has been magnified since then?
You know, I think some of the critique of the Ronald Reagan Centennial is really about one of definition and understanding, right? So how do we define political greatness? Is it that we agree with every policy? Do we agree with the approach, the governing style? Or do we say this is a person who really had a long-lasting impact on politics in this country? And I think if that's our definition, then we cannot disagree that Ronald Reagan certainly was that figure. To think about not only tax policy changes, changing views on the U.S. government in terms of AIDS and funding and research for AIDS and, you know, our understanding of communities that are affected. But to look at Ronald Reagan as this figure who has influenced subsequent presidents, also strongly influenced political parties, both Democrats and Republicans, responded to that Reagan legacy and continue to do so. And so I think that is really his mark on American politics and one that continues and endures well beyond his time.
And how have Democrats, and let's take case in point, the current president, who evidently has been reading quite a bit about Ronald Reagan over the last few months, how has he been influenced, and how have Democrats been influenced by that presidency?
I think if you go back to 1992 and the creation of the Democratic Leadership Council, created by people like Joe Lieberman, Bill Clinton, Al Gore, of saying the Democratic Party has to move more to the center. We cannot be the sort of, polar opposite to the Republican Party. We have to think about how can we bring more people into this process, and if moving to the center is the way to do so, that's what they will do. And so I think you see that quite a bit with the Obama administration of trying to redefine what it means to be a Democrat so that it's not solely, one definition or one view, and trying to incorporate a bigger group of Americans into that. And facing some opposition from traditional Democrats who are saying, but what about our base, right? And so in this move to become more cooperative in politics to try to appease more voters, what's being gained, what's being lost? But I think Obama definitely has a sense of that Reagan legacy and sort of operating within it in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Why did he, I haven't even seen it yet. I saw, as I was doing something in the kitchen yesterday, my husband said, Obama is on with Bill O'Reilly. And I said, really?
Right.
So I went in and saw about 2 minutes, and then the phone rang and I taped it, and I never, with all the Super Bowl excitement in Wisconsin, never got back to seeing the interview. Why do you think he granted an interview with Bill O'Reilly? And did you have a chance to see it yesterday?
I did see it, and it was perhaps one of the most awkward interviews
was it?
I've ever seen. And, I tend to think that whether you agree with the person who's holding the office, whether that's the person for whom you voted, I teach my students, I teach my daughter, we always respect the president, right? The office of the president, because it really represents us as an American people.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't like who's in office, the great thing is we have the opportunity to vote in a different way. But for me, O'Reilly didn't really give Obama a chance to finish a sentence without interrupting. And it just, I don't know what was supposed to come of it. I think to the president, it was, well, let me extend this olive branch, right? O'Reilly has complained about access. There's been this very contentious relationship between O'Reilly and the administration, and perhaps Obama felt this would be a good way to do it. I'm not sure that happened. I'm not sure what the benefit of it was, but it was definitely difficult to watch.
Hmm. But I should watch it tonight.
You have to
all
watch.
All right. I have to watch it. Okay. Right. I will. We're going to welcome
phone
calls.
That's your homework for today.
Thank you. Our guest this hour for All Things Political is Professor Kalila Brown-Dean. She is the Peter Strauss Family Assistant Professor of Political Science and African American Studies at Yale University, resident fellow of the Institute for Social and Policy Studies, and a research fellow at the Macmillan Center for International and Area Studies at Yale. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. Front and center has been Egypt for quite some time now, a very, very important story. But we can also, and we have yet to talk about health care reform, what a couple judges have ruled here, who will ultimately decide this. We'll talk a little bit about the president's budget and the difficult position that everybody's in terms of what to fund and what needs to go to by the wayside, and whether or not some of the entitlement programs do need to be taken on, because that's where the money goes, how states are really struggling right now. Ronald Reagan turning 100 yesterday, his lasting legacy. We can talk more about that. And here is how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday. Last week, you probably are aware of this, NASA announced that the Kepler mission has discovered over 1,000 new potential planets. We will have two guests with us, Professor Sarah Seeger, professor of planetary science and physics at MIT and a member of NASA's Kepler science team. And Bill Nye, the science guy, will also join us. He's a remarkable guy, an engineer, a comedian, an author, educator, and inventor, Emmy award-winning TV writer, producer, and host, and a vice president of the Planetary Society. So that's coming up, hour number two. We go to questions now for and comments for Professor Kalila Brown-Dean from Yale. And we start our calls today with Tim from Fort Collins, Colorado. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I was going to back you up and see if we could have a little discussion about educating yourself about other parts of the world. And the first thing I wanted to say was that I live out here in the Front Range of Colorado, and we have a interesting situation on public TV that we've all, in Denver area, there's always been two public television broadcasting stations. And so there's been a kind of a bit of a competition between them, and they kind of separate their audiences a bit. And the small station, I guess you'd say, they carry, since digital has come on and digital TV, they now carry these broadcasts. So they carry Al Jazeera in English. These are all in English.
Really?
Yeah. French station, I think it's called Channel 24 News. They carry Germany News. So these are all news broadcasts that are worldwide news broadcasts in English.
Oh, my.
They also carry Russia Today, which is a news broadcast from Russia in English about America and world events. They carry the Indian broadcast.
And
I find it pretty fascinating. I quite honestly, among all the broadcasts I've seen, including PBS, etc., Al Jazeera is my best source for worldwide news. And I mean just straight-on news. You see maybe a slight tilt to their broadcasting, but I think it's because they have the money,
right?
Quite honestly, and it's quite interesting to me to, you know, this is just my viewpoint, but India, highly biased, every time it comes on every night is a lead story about how bad Pakistan is, something horrible happening in Pakistan. Russia Today is very heavily strong, has strong has stories about the poor in America and all the dark sides of America, a lot of information on that. And then French 24 I find pretty interesting, too, because they can take the time to have some discussions occasionally, too.
Lucky but, you to have this.
The best is Al Jazeera by far, or just regular information.
Uh-huh. Yeah. This has to be fairly rare, Professor Brown-Dean, doesn't it?
Extremely rare to think about major markets
right,
like New York and L.A., where people don't have access to so many different countries, news perspectives, I think it's fantastic. And to be able to sift through it and say, this is a station that appeals to me, this is not, this is what the bias is, and, you know, you emphasize straight-on news, that's such a rare occurrence in and of itself these days that it's wonderful that you have access to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I just found it so interesting that, I mean, this has just happened since digital has come on, that Al Jazeera has such fine quality news to me. I mean, I'm kind of like your comment. I'm amazed that the rest of the United States doesn't carry it in some way, somewhere.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to do a show on Al Jazeera sometime. That would be a good thing to do, to find out what's going on politically that keeps it from being broadcast here. Oh, I'd love to wake up and have a TV set. You know, we have digital. You think of all the channels we get, but we don't get any of those channels.
Okay. No, not at all.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim, very much for the call. Jim in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. If people will grab a piece of paper in a moment, I'll give them a couple sources of information. And it strikes me that in Egypt, and I think in a lot of ways in the United States, that the governments don't want people to know. And a good example, for example, is that Mubarak has been characterized by a lot of people as our friend, but friends don't let friends torture. And two sources that I'd give you, one, the Chicago Tribune, February 3rd, page 16 of the front page, Mubarak uses fear factor for gain, has excellent information on the life of the poor in Egypt and gives people many, many insights. The other book relates to Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, and it made me think of a line from World War One song over there, and it said, the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, and we won't be coming back till it's over there. But in reality, the way our foreign policy works, it's never over there, because they're looking for ways to engage us and justify power and control and defense spending overseas. In Zinn's book, Noam Chomsky has maintained that the appeal to security was largely fraudulent. Cold War framework was used as a device to justify the suppression of independent nationalism. And back in 1991, Colin Powell was quoted as saying that he was running out of villains and that he was down to Castro and Kim Il-sung. And so the point being that since then, of course, we've invented and overstated at least the threat of the crisis from terrorists from abroad, and we've used that to maintain our presence in the ability to interfere overseas. And people ought to start thinking about these things, because Murphy's Law says that what can go wrong will, and what goes around comes around. And so what's happening in Egypt is the fact that is a logical consequence of the fact that we haven't paid attention to Egypt, at least in terms of the people, but the government knew what was going on.
Thank you, Jim, for the call. Professor, there's a lot there. Professor Brown-Dean.
You know, I think that you really raise important points to think about the issue of timing, right? So when is it that the United States not just decides to intervene, but when do we start recognizing something as a problem and as an issue?
Mm-hmm.
To think about when Clinton was in office and his hesitancy to call what was going on in Rwanda a genocide, because using that term then compels the United States to intervene. So, you know, made the point about friends don't allow friends to torture their people. To use the term genocide means that we have to act in some way to prevent that from occurring, and that we have to take a position. And in many ways, that's what we're seeing in Egypt. To call something a revolution means that we have to then talk about our own interests and what we're going to do to support that. And whose definition of a revolution, which side of the revolution will the United States support? So I think that's why you see this sort of, well, let's sit back and watch and see what happens and allow the people of Egypt to decide for themselves, when really we've been aware of this for a while and have, you know, at least been aware of the major players in the process.
Is that a good strategy now for us, to sit back and see what happens?
You know, I think it again depends on who you're asking, right, and what the short and long-term benefits of that strategy will be. A lot of countries are very resistant to the United States taking a very heavy-handed approach, or of having the United States determine who Mubarak's successor should be. And rightfully so. The people of a country should be able to determine their direction and their destiny, because they certainly know their interests in a way that none of us can unless we, you know, have been born in that country or lived in that country for quite some time. So I think the wait-and-see approach is beneficial in that domain, but we also have to understand, often people tell me it's better to know the enemy that you're dealing with instead of to be surprised by the next enemy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if we're saying, no, we don't agree with how Mubarak has treated his people, but at least we knew what that treatment was, what will we expect? What will we see with the next leader?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a very fine line that the administration will have to walk in terms of determining who will the next leader be and to what extent can the United States help protect the people of Egypt if that is, in fact, what Egyptians want us to do.
Thanks, Jim, as always, for your call. Alan in Appleton, hi.
Good morning. I kind of want to discuss the president's interview last night, and Mr. O'Reilly was, as usual, just as himself. The one other thing I wanted to bring up just kind of goes along with the point. My nephew became an Eagle Scout and had a ceremony this last fall. And I went to the ceremony. It was held at a church. One of his mentors was the minister from that church. And when the minister was speaking, he went off on a tirade about how the president was not expressing his faith in a way the way that he should for the country.
The minister was saying this?
The minister did. And I walked out. I got up. I was so pissed off. I walked out, and I shook my head as I was walking out. And there were actually a couple state senators that showed up there, or representatives. I'm not sure which they were. And after he was done, they did not see this. But I was going to bring it up with them, but it was so offensive just for the whole fact of, you know, the scouts in general are an organization of respect, and which should be respect should be taught throughout. You know, they respect the military, they respect the president, and just for that to happen there, I was so offended, and there were a few other people that were offended too. But which I think it's also kind of illegal just for tax purposes, but I can't let it go there. But, you know, watching that last night, I didn't find it unusual that O'Reilly talked over the president, which I think is very disrespectful. I don't think anybody should talk over the president when he's speaking. I figured he would do that. That's just kind of the person he is. But I think it kind of, this happening, and if they play it, which I don't think they're going to play it on their network very much, because it's going to disarm O'Reilly as far as the speech that they use towards the president. They cannot, he looked fantastic there. I don't know how they could use anything that he said in that speech against him.
Well, let me say congratulations to your nephew first and foremost. I think that's a wonderful achievement and says a lot about the base of support that he has. I think that what you're expressing, though, is what a lot of people have expressed, particularly over the last few weeks. How do we restore a culture of civility and respect in the U.S.? And maybe some would say, well, you can't restore what you haven't had. But how do we establish that culture, which says that we can be passionate about our political views, we can be determined about our political goals, but we can also say that whatever party we align with, whatever ideology we support, we are all a part of the same democratic process. And that, you know, I thought of this, you know, watching the State of the Union address, sitting together shouldn't determine civility. You know, where you sit, whether it's in a pew in a church as you were for this ceremony, or whether you are in the halls of Congress or your local, you know, mayoral chamber, there should be a bottom line base of respect in this country that binds us together.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
And I think that's not partisan. That's not ideological. That is simply saying that is, you know, basic manners. And to think that you have these Eagle Scouts who are very impressionable, who have made these wonderful accomplishments, that is not the culture that we are mirroring to them. That's not the value that we impart to them when we take a ceremony like that and make it a political, soapbox for the minister or for others who agreed with him. So that's my basic response whenever I hear people say that, to think, how do we say we want to be a country, a value-based country, whatever those values are, and there's a real gap between that principle and the actual practice.
Let's just hope that Congresswoman Giffords fully recovers, goes back to Congress, and is a daily reminder to everybody in that body of what people can be. You know, she can do a lot in that regard, and already has, but one only hopes that it's not short-lived.
Right. I agree.
Thanks, Ellen, very much for your call. Let's go to Pat in New Glarus. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a couple of observations, if I may. One is that the situation in Egypt is not a surprising one, and anyone familiar with U.S. foreign policy would have anticipated it. It's important to understand the broader context. The United States government has always been in favor of democracy if and only if the results of democracy are conducive to U.S. foreign relations, the privatization of industry, multinational investment, and so on. When democracy in other countries runs counter to those interests, the United States historically has repeatedly intervened to undermine and thwart democracy and to overthrow democratically elected governments. This was going on decades before Ronald Reagan was elected, and it continues to go on. It goes back long before the origins of the Cold War, and it's continued since the end of World War II in Guatemala, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Indonesia, Vietnam, Laos. It's just a repeated pattern over and over again. Now, the United States government knows exactly what it's doing. These people are not stupid. Those who are in power have a very sophisticated understanding of geopolitical affairs. The United States mass media has failed miserably, however, in bringing this to the attention of the American public. It's not that other people in the world don't know it. They know it very well. They're the ones who are actually witnessing the effects of these kinds of policies. It's only in the United States that this kind of thing is unknown. Perfect example is the situation in Guatemala during the 8 years that Ronald Reagan was president. It was an absolute fascist state. Tens of thousands of people were killed. Hundreds of thousands were made refugees. The country was under a state of martial law. Rural guards and civil guards were carrying out ground sweeps. Women, children, farmers, peasant co-ops were being wiped out. And it was never addressed in the United States media. I mean, it was simply off the map. That's just a tiny example. The same thing.
All right, before you go to the same thing, let's get a response to what you've had to say. Professor Brondine.
Yeah, I think the question becomes, how do we define democracy, right? If we think of democracy as government of the people and by the people, to which people are we referring? Because often in the countries that you just listed, the people determining the face of democracy, determining the course of democracy, are not the people who would be governed by those democracies. So I think it's important to understand that for the United States and for a number of other countries, nothing is done politically out of pure altruistic motivations, right? That's not politically savvy to do that. It's always about what will this mean for the United States in the short term and in the long term. How do we build allies that can support our interests, determine the course of our action, and how can we ensure our strength or our stronghold in a particular part of the world for whatever reason that may be? Mm-hmm. Those reasons may vary president to president, but it's always about maintaining U.S. interests broadly defined. And so I think that is important to understand that, and to also think about how do those interests then become magnified when we have these world events that suddenly make it onto the public agenda and our awareness is heightened there. So I agree with you that it's not that this was unknown or completely came out of left field, but now that there is public awareness, and now that people are looking to the United States for a response, what will that response be?
Mm-hmm. And, Pat, I need to thank you here. We have to pause, and we have many people who want to join the conversation. Thank you for your comments this morning. It's All Things Political for this Monday, and our guest is Professor Kalila Brown-Dean. She is the Peter Strauss Family Assistant Professor of Political Science and African American Studies at Yale University, resident fellow of the Institute for Social and Policy Studies, and a research fellow at the Macmillan Center for International and Area Studies at Yale. Our phone number, one line is open right now. They've been crowded, so grab it if you'd like. 800-486-8655. Email, haven't had any of those. You can use that form of modern communication if you'd like. It's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, NASA's Kepler mission has discovered its first Earth-sized planet candidates and its first candidates in the habitable zone. I keep thinking during my lifetime somebody's going to find some kind of being or something that does a little talking or dancing or has great wisdom in some other planet. And at any rate, these stories confirm that that could happen, maybe not in my lifetime, but sometime. So they've found that these are the first candidates in the habitable zone. This is a region where liquid water could exist on a planet's surface. And so it's very exciting news. And we'll be speaking with two guests, Bill Nye, the science guy, is joining us, and Professor Sarah Seeger, professor of planetary science and member of NASA's Kepler science team. I find this extraordinarily fascinating. And the fact that people can study all of that is fascinating. Come up with these discoveries. So that's our number two of our program. We continue now with Professor Brown Dean, and let us go to Dan in Three Lakes. Thanks for waiting, Dan. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I would just like to point out three quick things that are somewhat disparate. Bill O'Reilly proved his ignorance by claiming the existence of God is proven by the fact you cannot explain the tides. The reason that the shores of Tripoli is referred to in the Marine Corps hymn is because we had to send the Marines over to Tripoli to recover missionaries that were over there telling Muslims they could convert, they should convert to Christianity. And that was 1793, as reported by Professor Oren in his book, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, The Story of the U.S. in the Middle East. And Ronald Reagan did have a great impact on the world and the country, not all of which was good, and most of the people that tout him as a saint almost are completely unaware of the fact that he raised taxes more than six times and that he was a major contributor to the downfall of unions in this country when he fired the air traffic controllers. And now we have such a disparity of incomes in this country, it has never been worse or greater than in right now in August of 1929.
Thank you. Thanks for the call, Professor.
I mean, what can I say? Thanks for the information.
There you go. Thanks for the information. Let's talk a little bit. We haven't gotten to this yet about the budget, presidential budget, which we'll hear about fairly soon and no more details about this. As you look at where we're spending money and the pickle that all the states are in and the fact that we're the deficit and all of that, do you see anywhere, Professor Brown Dean, other than entitlements, or do we have to go to entitlements to cut the deficit and to allow us to be able to continue to fund programs like education?
You know, I am someone who is always very leery when we start talking budgets and, you know, who deserves to have their funding cut and who should not. Because I always think that if we start cutting those entitlements, we in many ways will be making the situation worse, right? When you talk about states, the budget crises that most states are facing, if the federal government starts changing its allotments to those funding sources, then it becomes the state's responsibility, local government's responsibilities, which we know are already in some ways trapped, so that most local governments cannot raise any revenue independent of what state budget guidelines mandate. And so I think that could be an issue. To think about one of the most significant line items in that budget is actually on defense spending. What would it look like if we took a portion of that money and devoted it to education, to say to our young people, let us invest in you now so that you can become more productive Americans, so that you can contribute positively to your communities and get to a point where your generation won't need the same level of entitlement that my generations and other generations may need. And so I think education is an important investment in our young people and one that really will serve the country well. So I would hope that the president, I understand it's a tough situation, but I would hope that the president, I would hope that state governors and state legislators would be very cautious in taking money away from education.
What about the money that the president called for, the drive that he wanted to launch at the State of the Union to rebuild infrastructure, to really fund innovations in this country to make us the best in the world? Do you anticipate a struggle in his being able to get funds for that? Do you agree with that policy?
Well, I think that being innovative is important. I think it will be a unique distinction for the United States. But we also need to question what will the benefit of that be. I think that if we can create new jobs in that sector, I think that's a powerfully important goal and one that we really should rally around, because that then has an impact not just for our image and for, you know, our sort of superlative of being unique in this level, but it is something that will benefit Americans where we need it the most. To think about the number of people who are unemployed or underemployed at this time, if that is a sector where we can see significant growth and sort of, you know, outlast some of the challenges we face now, I think that's an important direction.
Joe in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. You know, speaking of budgets, we've been hearing about this $1.5 billion that we give Egypt every year. What budget does that come out of? And is that budget, I mean, how many other countries are we giving money to like that? And is that money on the table for cuts for this, you know, economic problems we have?
Well, I think a lot of that funding is wrapped into some of our defense spending, particularly now when we think about, you know, counterterrorism efforts and our goal of increasing security in other parts of the world as a way of promoting security here in the United States. I don't see that as anything that will have a sharp cut, nor do I see it as being something that will have a very public cut, right? One of the benefits for any presidential administration is that the average American doesn't pay as much attention to foreign policy and defense spending as we do domestic spending. And so that has always been a way that administrations have been able to sort of do things at their will, you know, members of Congress as well, not just the president, to sort of, you know, decide what the alliances should be and what types of resources do we need to devote to other countries in order to make things more stable here in the U.S.
It isn't all that. Wasn't there a study a few years ago that showed what Americans think we give in foreign aid is a whole lot more money than what we actually give?
It is. And to think about how that aid is actually transmitted to other places, whether it's through, you know, organizations and support for associations that go places to support volunteers who are working in particular countries, that is a very different form of aid. It's not that the U.S. is simply writing a check to, you know, Mubarak saying, you know, congratulations, here's $1 billion for you. But that aid is done in a very intricate way that is, you know, a little different from how we as the American people generally conceive of it.
Thank you, Joe, for your call. Frank and Stanley. Hello, Frank.
Yes, I'd like to tell you that Al Jazeera is available almost anywhere if you have a computer.
Mm-hmm.
My son is a computer guru, and he got me Al Jazeera. We have a thing called Roku, R-O-K-U, that puts up Netflix and Weather Underground and a whole bunch of other things like that. And you can get Al Jazeera set up on that program.
What's the program? Roku?
Roku is the name of it. So I imagine if you went to Amazon or someplace and did a search on Roku, you could find out about it. I don't know about it because I'm not the computer guru.
Yeah, your son is.
In any event, on NPR over the weekend, they had the individual on that's the head of Al Jazeera English.
Hmm.
And he said that they just report the news. They don't do any analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very interesting to watch and see what El Jazeera has to say, because they don't say, well, this is going to happen because of that or anything. Yeah. They just report what's going on.
Frank, how do you spell that? Because somebody's going to want to know, and I won't know how to answer them. How do you spell that? Roku? Oh, it's R-O-K-U. Thank you, Chris.
ROKU.com. That's it.
Thank you, Frank, very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we'll try and get the head of Al Jazeera English speaking on this show, too. It'd be a good show. Thank you for your call. Susan in Janesville, hi.
Hi. I would like to make a comment. Basically, you had a gentleman that attended a ceremony for Eagle Scouts, and he was offended. Actually, it sounded like he was quite irate because a speaker there thought that he showed disrespect for our sitting president, President Obama. And so it was, of course, his choice. He decided to walk out. He didn't like this. And I do agree. There is definitely too much disrespect for our sitting presidents. But, you know, I'd like to know, if they were bad-mouthing George Bush when he was our sitting president, would he have walked out? And I have never, ever, and I have never missed a presidential election, but I have never in my life seen and heard so much disrespect for a sitting president as our George Bush. All along the line, yes, there has, and there shouldn't be. I don't care who our president is. But I just don't like, I'm surprised I was even allowed to speak because it's all, I'm just wondering, has there ever been a good Republican running for president or office? And I would like to see truth in our religious and our public school systems where they do teach history, they do reach into politics, but the truth. It can't be that hard, just the truth. No adding the professor or the teachers, adding their own thoughts, because that isn't, I mean, they're not teaching. You're pulling them to what your point of view. At any rate, that was just my comment. I would like to see, as a matter of fact, I stopped taking our local paper when President Bush was our president. You teach your children and your students, you show respect. It's President Bush. It's President Obama. But they just would say Bush, Bush, Bush. And they, yes, in all fairness, they do say Obama. And I do not like Obama. I think he's bringing America down to her knees. But he does deserve to be called President Obama in our papers and in our reporting. I would like to instill that, especially for students.
All right, Susan. Thank you. Thanks for the call. Yes. Professor Brown-Dean.
I do want to say that, you know, my comments were saying that I don't really care which party people align with, which ideology they embrace, but there's a certain basic level of respect that should dominate political discourse and involvement. And that stretches beyond the person who is sitting in that seat. And so I think that the, you know, caller's point is clear, that we need to have that level of respect. But to the point of truth, truth is not as clear-cut as we would like to suggest when you're talking about history. The story that is told in history depends on the person telling it. And we're seeing that in the U.S. right now with this debate over the Civil War and how we should commemorate that.
Mm-hmm.
When people are having succession balls and talk about the Civil War and not talk about slavery. So for the people who are holding the balls, that
right,
is their truth.
Right.
That is their version of the Civil War. To the people who are descendants of slaves, it is a very different story. So I think we have to understand that it's not about imparting a bias. It's not about using a classroom as a soapbox, but to let students know there are various vantage points. That's part of what makes America great, that we can understand those perspectives and allow students to determine for themselves what that truth, whatever that is, what that will be, but to give them exposure to various viewpoints, even when they don't comport with our own.
Yeah, it's a difficult issue because there are you don't want to stifle legitimate kind of criticism of policies or actions that many people may consider wrong. I mean, we know now that slavery was wrong and that it was wrong for Thomas right. Jefferson to own as many slaves as he did. And right. for us to kind of whitewash that for a long time in elevating the founding fathers, that also has to be a part of his truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And we have to say that there are certain things that we know undeniably. We know that slavery was not the only cause of the Civil War, but it was a major cause.
No slavery, no Civil War. That's
exactly.
the way I see it. Yeah.
And we have to understand that and that timing.
Right.
So to be aware of that as well.
Well, you've been a terrific guest. I hope you'll join us again. I really enjoyed the hour.
I loved it, and thank you so much.
Good. Oh, I'm glad you did. Oh, good.
Then congratulations to the Packers.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, and she ended on the perfect note, didn't she? She's a good guest. We'll have her again. Professor Kalila Brown-Dean, Peter Strauss Family Assistant Professor of Political Science and African-American Studies at Yale University. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease as well for on-air production, for all of your great calls as well. Thanks.